Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Three Dads and a Baby, Adventures in Modern Parenting, by Ian Jenkins, M.D. Narrated by Graham Halstead. Chapter 1. Neonate Life Destruction Syndrome. We'd heard crazy stories from all sorts of friends and relatives about how a baby would explode our lives. "You think you're tired at work," one said. "Wait till baby." Another told us he couldn't possibly bother with canvas grocery bags. "It's just way too much to think about after a baby." One couple didn't eat at a restaurant for a full year after their baby was born, despite living 15 minutes from their parents, who had successfully raised three children to adulthood. We had friends who never flushed a toilet after 8 p.m. to avoid waking their kids. But neonate life destruction syndrome was not going to happen to us. Even when she was just 6 days old, everything had come together. No one was exhausted. We had her routine sorted out. Baby was kicking ass and taking milk. She wasn't quite ready for a STEM career or the United States Senate, but she did seem ready for college, drinking, sleeping all day, partying all night. We'd had 20 visitors. We'd watched 2 movies at home, and we'd posted all her adventures on social media, from her first moments to napping with our dogs. I'd already gotten a dozen very serious replies to my toileting post. "Any reason I can't dangle a poopy baby over a bidet?" asking for a friend. I hadn't taken leave from my career as a hospital doctor. I'd even polished off several work presentations, hosted a webinar on hospital safety, and chaired 2 hospital committee meetings. So we felt ready to take her out into the world. Why not shopping? We needed both staples and treats, as every healthy family runs on a mixture of organic vegetables and chocolate. In our first humbling parenting experience, we'd lost track of what day it was and arrived at Costco midday on Saturday. But baby slept through it all, snuggled to my partner Jeremy's chest with a baby-porting gadget called a ring sling. One admiring shopper went out of her way to thank my partner for doing his part. "Used to be the men made the women do all the work. More and more men are contributing. The times sure are a-changing." Jeremy, ever the gracious pastor's son, smiled and thanked her. After she walked on, he said, "Lady, you don't know the half of it." The woman hadn't realized it, but she'd just met a true modern family. 3 fathers had accompanied our bundle of joy to the store that day. Alan and I had been partnered for 14 years, and Jeremy had joined us 5 years ago, making us a polyamorous triad, or thruple. Our baby's genetic mom had come with us to the store and smiled, watching people try to guess at the relationships that bound the 4 of us. And earlier that day, we'd fed baby some colostrum from her amazing surrogate, who'd been pumping precious breast milk for us since the birth. She'd done all the hard work for us, and we were having an amazing week precisely because none of us had to go through the trials of childbirth or breastfeeding. All told, it took 3 fathers and 2 women to make our beloved little one. We know, right there, some people have some strong opinions about our decision to raise children, despite knowing nothing else about us. According to the American Library Association's records of book suppression, the children's book Heather Has 2 Mommies was the 9th most challenged book in the 1990s. America has changed a lot since then. But imagine what the reception would be for Heather Has 3 Polyamorous Daddies and 2 Mommies. We're not an ordinary family. But do we have crazy lives, wild parties, unstable relationships, lots of drama, and concerned families? No, not even remotely. We work, we clean the house, we ask each other what we should have for dinner, we pay taxes, we Netflix. Nothing to see here. But was becoming poly parents an adventure? Oh, yes. Chapter 2. The Offer. 27 months earlier. I downed a carefully selected appetizer with my two boyfriends at a Memorial Day party. I had to save calories for the cake Jeremy had assembled out of red, white, and blue layers so the slices looked like American flags. He'd wandered away for a margarita refill, and when he returned, he leaned in and whispered, "Hey, do we want to have kids?" His friends Stephanie and Julie had offered him embryos to adopt. They'd done two cycles of IVF with a sperm donor, and now they had three beautiful kids, plus two frozen embryos left over. They didn't have room for any more children in their family, but they didn't want to discard the embryos. Would we be interested? We would. We needed to think long and hard about it, but we were intrigued. We agreed to drink more margaritas and discuss it at home. In our 8 pre-Jeremy years, Alan brought up having kids a dozen times. Once he said he'd be a great father, and I could be, too, with supervision. We knew he was right, but we never took the first step. Then Jeremy entered the picture, a zookeeper and nurturer by trade. With a third voice at the table, our conversations about parenting began to change. It says quite a lot about my second partner that Julie picked him to raise two of her children. But Julie wasn't the first to tell us we should have kids. For years, our good friend Neha had been nudging us toward parenthood. We'd known her and her husband, Fred, since we moved to San Diego. Alan and Neha had worked together as psychiatrists on a children's unit, and Fred had rotated through the hospital medicine unit where I worked. Neha had impeccable taste and a knack for telling us that we'd disappointed her in a way that felt like a compliment because she knew we were capable of much more. Our two biggest crimes, one, hosting parties inside rather than using our deck with views of sparkly San Diego and Tijuana, and two, failing to get on the baby train. "I'm worried," she once said over hors d'oeuvres at her place, "that you're going to put it off until it's too late, which would be a most regrettable error." Then we talked about the barriers. It may sound odd, but in our day-to-day lives, being in a gay throuple felt entirely normal. We lived in California. All of our friends and co-workers embraced us, so we didn't think of it as a barrier. Our problem was biological. None of us had a uterus. When Neha would ask why we hadn't had kids, I'd joke that we'd been trying desperately but seemed to be infertile. We'd heard mixed things about adoption, the obvious solution, from our next-door neighbors. They'd had home interviews to get listed as adoptive parents. To make their home kid-safe, they'd installed a retractable, heavy-duty pool cover, one an adult could walk across. They were lovely people, but they still got turned down. What would happen when our interviewer saw our uncovered death trap of a pool, co-owned by three unmarried gay guys? We didn't think we had a snowball's chance in hell of being accepted, and didn't like the idea of some agency coming to our house to pass judgment on our fitness as parents in the first place. At this point, Fred and Neha's two youngest kids burst out of their room in tears, accusing each other of stealing toys and other crimes that seem unforgivable to children and meaningless to adults. "Hush! Stop this nonsense and apologize to each other. Now shoo!" said Neha. "Don't make any decisions on the basis of our children's current behavior," she added after they'd exchanged insincere apologies. "I'm told this disgraceful behavior will eventually come to an end." "When they're 20?" Fred asked. "Do not frighten them," she replied, as if we couldn't hear. "This is a delicate situation." Fred laughed and asked about IVF. Alan said it sounded terrible. He'd heard figures of $8,000 each for the egg donor and agency, plus legal fees, test costs, and other hassles, and the huge whopper, surrogacy. According to our Google searches, surrogacy costs were preposterous. One site said that fees ran from $90,000 to $130,000, or more in high-demand states like California. Other sites said to expect between $165,000 and $240,000. That's right, $250,000 to make a baby. Then you have to raise it. I assume that any $250,000 baby would expect to go to a private school and receive one-on-one coaching in equestrian sports, the kind where you wear a velvet helmet and ride your own horse. Alan is many things, but perhaps first and foremost, he is an excellent internet shopper, and he had already done his research on bargain surrogacy. You could get a surrogate for far less in Africa, Asia, or India, he explained, but not without other hassles. In the famous case of Baby Gammy, an Australian couple had a child by a Thai surrogate. The kid had Down syndrome, and the parents returned home without her. The media made it sound like the couple had dumped an abnormal baby on an impoverished surrogate. But a court later found that, contrary to the scandalous headlines, they hadn't abandoned Baby Gammy. Civil unrest had forced them to flee Thailand while Gammy was too sick to travel. Plus, the surrogate had wanted to keep their baby. "I need another drink just hearing about that," said Neha, waving an empty glass in Fred's direction. He refilled it. "Fred makes killer cocktails. That night we were having French 75s, gin, lemon juice, simple syrup, champagne. If Fred and Neha invite you to dinner, you should go." Alan wasn't done with his stories about foreign surrogacy. Another Thai surrogate had refused to relinquish a baby she bore for a gay couple, saying she disagreed with their sexual orientation. With multiple messy surrogacy cases making headlines, Thailand banned international surrogacy, creating legal nightmares for couples who already had pregnant surrogates. Several other Asian countries, some of which had previously lacked any surrogacy regulations at all, also imposed new laws. Many couples turned to Cambodian surrogates, only to find themselves in limbo when the country jailed an Australian nurse who ran a surrogacy clinic, stopped issuing visas to surrogate-born babies, and froze payments to surrogates. About 50 babies got stuck in Cambodia. Mexico made more sense for us. We can see Tijuana from our house. But gay couples had ended up with their babies stuck there too, when Mexico followed the Asian nations and also clamped down on surrogacy businesses. Surrogacy in the United States isn't simple either, due to a complex patchwork of state regulations. Louisiana punishes anyone entering into a paid surrogacy contract with civil and criminal penalties. At the time, New York and Michigan considered all surrogacy contracts void and compensated surrogacy agreements criminal. New York legalized surrogacy in 2020. In Arizona and Indiana, contracts are considered unenforceable, but some courts will grant pre-birth parentage orders to intended parents. 7 states create significant legal hurdles for intended parents, and many others require additional steps, like amendments to birth certificates. Only 10 states and the District of Columbia make it easy, reliably issuing pre-birth orders to name both parents on the child's birth certificate. Being gay adds even more challenges. In Louisiana, assisted reproduction is permitted, but only for heterosexual married couples. In Idaho and Tennessee, a gay couple would have to take their child to another state, obtain a second parent adoption for the non-genetic parent, then return to their home state and seek recognition of the adoption, just to be named legal parents. As of late 2019, it was unclear if Mississippi would recognize an out-of-state second parent adoption, and Nebraska simply won't. If you're the non-genetic parent to a child born by surrogacy in Nebraska, even if you're married to your same-sex partner, you remain a legal nobody. You get to worry about the consequences if your partner dies, or you get divorced, or even if you just want to take your child on a trip without the legal parent. Consider one example of the extra challenges facing same-sex parents. A couple in Utah, known only as John and Noel to protect their privacy, were blocked from parenting by surrogacy because they're gay. Utah state law required a married couple to submit evidence that an intended mother is medically unfit to carry a child before surrogacy can proceed. This intrusive law at least provided a path to parenting for straight couples and lesbians, but it completely shut out gay men. What was the idea behind this law? I imagined that Utah lawmakers thought long and hard about the number of penises found in various relationships, and then, I'm just guessing here, decided that zero penises equals acceptable, one penis equals optimal, and two penises equals ick. Then, motivated by either malice or willful indifference, they wrote a law to keep gays from parenting. Utah is a conservative state, and conservatives resent state intrusion into private affairs. Therefore, Utah legislators had no choice but to climb into bed with John and Noel and count their penises and weigh in on their fitness to have children. This wasn't 1950. John and Noel's case went to state Supreme Court in 2017, and the court decided in their favor in 2019. When I write that out, it sounds insane. At least the three of us had specifically decided to live in California. Surrogacy might be impossible for a throuple, but better California than Utah or Louisiana, right? Even putting aside legal concerns, if we were going to try surrogacy, we wanted to work with friends. Someone we could trust to eat right, go to appointments, take vitamins, not drink, and abstain from skydiving and heroin while pregnant. Someone who'd care about our babies, maybe remain in their lives as an aunt figure, but not try to snatch the kid. Alan had an Ethiopian friend from medical school who'd half-joked about having his kids and worried about her eggs getting old and dusty. Single, childless, and nearly 40, she knew it was soon or never. We liked the idea of beautiful, intelligent, mixed-race babies. A little melanin is not a bad thing when you're growing up in San Diego, Alan said. But these discussions never went beyond the "our kids would be so cool" stage. Forgive me, Neha said, but you're getting old and dusty too. Like I said, putting this off would be a most regrettable error. What if they don't want to? Asked Fred. Parenting was complicated for us. For them, it's crazy. But that was then, back in an era of pure hypotheticals. Things felt a lot different after margaritas, American flag cake, and an offer of 2 frozen embryos. Parenthood suddenly became much more plausible. Chapter 3. 16. Beer. Pickup truck. A block from our house, a dark curve in the road gives parked cars a measure of privacy and a lovely view of the San Diego skyline. Teens park there. In the afternoon, they smoke weed. In the evening, judging by the litter they leave behind, they eat fast food and have sex. That's disgusting, Alan would say when we walked our dogs past the evidence, and Jeremy would reply, "Well, at least they're using protection." Our neighbors, the rejected adoptive parents, drive an enormous monster truck, and when they come across occupied cars at night, they pull up nose to nose, flick on their brights, and blind the teenagers until the kids lose their nerve and drive off. Some teens had parked there in a pickup truck that Memorial Day. We really don't care about loitering or fornicating, but we hate littering. So, inspired by our neighbors, Jeremy drove by them slowly and used his cell phone to snap a picture of their license plate, which scared them away. "It pisses me off," said Alan, "that we'd have to go through an expensive, crazy process to reproduce while some 16-year-olds are drinking beer and making oops babies in pickup trucks." Back home, we talked about all the hurdles we'd face if we adopted embryos. First, which 2 of us would get to be parents? Being in a throuple meant we had 3 salaries to defray costs, but someone would have to volunteer to be left off the birth certificate, without the rights of a legal parent. Second, would an in vitro fertilization, IVF, clinic work with us? Hospitals are legally required to treat every patient that comes in the door, but IVF is an elective procedure. Could a clinic decide we were one parent too many? Third, how would we handle the poly thing with the kid? This last one seemed the easiest. I just didn't believe that kids who grew up with a loving, respectful, honest parental relationship would have a problem with it. Our kids would just be lucky to have an extra parent. Alan worried about all sorts of problems that could arise, like how a kid would fill out financial aid forms with three parents. We all worried about them getting teased, suffering over a choice we'd made. But there wasn't anything we could do about society besides live in a tolerant community, which we already did. Gay couples don't stumble into parenthood by accident. It's always a deliberate act, and a complicated one. Expectations differ for us, too. I've had friends with cystic fibrosis who knew they'd never be able to father children, but most straight couples expect they'll be able to have kids. And their parents often ask, "When are you giving us a grandchild?" But parents of gay kids say something else. We often hear it when we come out. Even supportive parents may tell us, "I love you the same, but I really wanted grandchildren." After she had some time to acclimate, that's what my mother said. And, growing up, I'd learned the same lesson she had. Gays can't have children. In our pre-Jeremy years, Alan and I had talked about kids on numerous occasions. The same concerns kept coming up. Besides not having a uterus and related hassles, our concerns were the earth and happiness. As for the earth, the news about our precious blue planet gets more and more terrifying every year. In late 2017, 15,000 scientists from 184 countries warned that we faced calamity if we didn't change our ways. Since 1970, the human population has grown by about 4 billion, while 60% of the wild animals and 83% of the mammals vanished. Bird populations from Europe to Antarctica have declined 50 to 88%. 97% fewer bluefin tuna and 99% fewer blue whales in the oceans. Up to 60 times fewer insects in Puerto Rico. 25 times as much biomass tied up in humans and livestock as in wild animals today. Carbon emissions surged in 2018, accelerating global warming. What are we doing about it? We have the science. 13 federal agencies concluded that humans are definitely causing global warming. And President Trump, who has said that the concept of global warming was created by the Chinese and has called it a very expensive hoax, appointed Scott Pruitt to run the Environmental Protection Agency, which he'd previously sought to eliminate. Pruitt hollowed it out from the inside, slashing regulations, deriding climate science, and welcoming coal lobbyists to advise him. Over 700 employees left the EPA in the months following his appointment. When ethics scandals finally pushed Pruitt out, a coal lobbyist replaced him. I'm doing my part. Our Xeriscaped yard only receives water from our rooftop collection system. I shower about 10 minutes a week. If I stink, no one's told me yet. We have two electric vehicles, which we charge with our rooftop solar. But we know the greatest single thing any individual person can do for the planet is this: reduce your baby emissions. I cannot hope to offset the vast environmental impact of kids, grandkids, etc., with short showers. As for the impact of kids on happiness, Alan and I had discussed it a bunch of times. Child-rearing comes with a lot of stress. A survey from Child magazine found babies slashed the amount of time spent with friends by about 2/3. Adults without kids are healthier, have more rewarding social lives, enjoy more recreational activities, suffer less stress, and are 75% more likely to report a full night of sleep, according to a poll of more than 1 million adults cataloged by polling platform Civic Science. A review of studies on child rearing and marital satisfaction published in 2003 found that parents had significantly lower satisfaction than non-parents. Mothers of infants were a third less likely to report high satisfaction, and the more kids a couple had, the worse the effect. The effects were worse in recent years, and for wealthier parents, people more accustomed to childless freedom, perhaps, people like us. Despite this, parents are a third more likely to report feeling very happy. John Dick, writing at QZ.com, wondered if that's because hardships might drive being childless, or maybe parents just say they're happy because they're supposed to. Or perhaps joy doesn't just have to come from extrinsic things and fabulous social lives. It can come from the adventure of raising a family, from teaching and nurturing others, from sacrifice, and from unconditional love. Perhaps. The research on parenting and happiness is mixed, and much of it measures happiness on a single dimension, as if exhaustion and fulfillment exist on some kind of continuum. What if parents find themselves more happy and more unhappy at the same time? Parenthood affects parents in different ways, some of which are personal and some of which can be predicted. We knew, for example, we could expect huge IVF costs. Other likely risks included strained partner relationships and exhaustion. As a colleague put it, "It's definitely worth it, but I never yelled at my husband before we had kids, and the sleep deprivation is dog shit." Had Alan and I just been saying these things because the barriers to having kids seemed too high to bother scaling? Maybe. Regardless, welcoming Jeremy into our home changed things. He's a joyful person and a nurturer. And once there were three of us, we had a special advantage for dealing with stress and exhaustion. However bad it got, two parents could always escape to a date night, or to sleep, while the third handled baby care. We had a built-in nanny. We just didn't have ovaries. For an hour after we got home that Memorial Day, we talked about our relationship, values, and resources. I've since learned the simplest reason to have kids, which I'll share later, but at the time, none of us really understood it. So we talked about our goals. We wanted our kids to enjoy rich educations and experience other cultures. We wanted them to understand just how lucky they would be compared to most people in the world today and throughout history. We would teach them empathy by involving them in generous acts and asking them to consider others' perspectives. We would compliment our children for being compassionate and considerate, not for being beautiful or handsome. We would praise hard work, not intelligence. We wouldn't hit them. If we had girls, we wanted them to know about female leaders, scientists, and artists, and feel free to be whomever they wanted. If we had boys, we wanted them to grow up without toxic masculinity, that American version of machismo that keeps boys and men from expressing tenderness or vulnerability. Just the idea that being nurturing is considered a feminine trait instead of a desirable trait is a tragic state of affairs. We wanted our children to know that they and everyone else had an inviolate right to bodily integrity and that intimacy was something you gave, never something you took. By then, we decided we'd make a throuple of good dads. But we had to know one thing for sure, that we were ready to put a child's needs ahead of our own. That's a start every child deserves. So we decided not to decide. Having children was too big a decision to make in an evening. We needed to sleep on it. Before we could sleep on it, we had to walk our golden doodles. For those of you unlucky enough not to have met a golden doodle, they're half golden retriever and half poodle, and they're sweet, intelligent, adorable, and playful. And they don't shed. If you don't have a child by poly triad, consider getting a doodle. We took the doodles on a looping walk through our neighborhood. Even then, the discussion didn't stop. We wanted our children to play an instrument. We wanted them to speak a second language, probably Spanish. On our walk, we realized we'd been saying our children the whole evening. We had decided. We would adopt those embryos and raise them in a loving home. I felt a mixture of excitement and trepidation. We were all on the same page about the rewards of parenting.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?